Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Hollywood is abuzz this week as the talk of Los Angeles is the 79th Annual Academy Awards, where the Oscars are being handed out. It's only a few short days until the nominees finding out if their name is called. They're also undoubtedly worried about the reaction to their attire on the red carpet before the awards, which has ended up receiving almost as much attention as the awards themselves in recent years. But being FX Guide, we're going to be talking this week about a far less public and maybe glitzy award, and those are the SciTech Awards that are given out by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And these awards are designed to reward advancements in R&D and inventions that essentially enhance the craft of filmmaking and motion pictures. There were four scientific and engineering awards handed out this year. Those are the Academy plaques. Two of them were actually centered in visual effects. One went to the folks at the Foundry. They're the makers of the Furnace plugins. And those of you who read FX Guide or listen to the podcast know that we're big fans of the Furnace plugins. We've actually done a live event for the Foundry out in LA, as well as worked on some DVDs for them. And in our online story, we interviewed Bill Collis from the Foundry, so be sure to read that. Also in our online story, we have a great detailed discussion of the ILM research, and ILM won a scientific and engineering award for their work on their image-based modeling system. And interestingly enough, ILM also won a technical achievement award, that's the Academy certificate, for their design and engineering of the OpenEXR file format. In our podcast this week, Mike Seymour speaks with Steve Sullivan, who's the Director of Research and Development for Industrial Light and Magic, and he discusses both the image-based modeling system as well as the OpenEXR format.
And thanks for that, John. And Steve, thanks very much for joining us to talk about the work at ILM, especially in the R&D department.
Sure, no problem.
So I guess, first of all, I need to say congratulations. It's obviously not something that ILM is unfamiliar with, being acknowledged for the work that you've done over the years.
Well, yeah, but it's always a shock and an honor to get one of these because they're pretty hard to come by, and we were just thrilled that the work's being recognized this way.
Yeah, I must say, of course, from my point of view, that I rate these more highly than perhaps some of the more popular category stuff where one tends to feel that it's a bit more of a... well, it's not to take anything away from those, of course, but this really is... a process, for those that aren't aware, that involves a review of the work that's been submitted and an assessment of the significance of it to the effectively development of filmmaking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very in-depth investigation, and the criterion is that there has to be impact and innovation shown over the course of many years and many films. So it's more of a long-term achievement award, which is why it's great to be recognized this way.
And if we could just start by discussing the image-based modeling system, when, I guess, was that first something that came up on your department's radar as something that you were going to look at?
Well, we started working on these problems back in 1999. I had a computer vision background, some other people had interests in computer vision problems, and we knew kind of what was possible academically, but we also knew that none of those research efforts could work in actual production because the data that you get in production is often much higher resolution, higher quality standards, but also they often have lots of artifacts and are shot in very unfavorable conditions. So we thought we would try to take some of the academic ideas and turn them into a real system and learn a lot along the way.
So could you give me an indication of some of the projects that it's being used in?
Sure. I think the first two were Minority Report and Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. So in Minority Report, we used it to make some virtual people that were in the Hall of Containment sequence, as well as a piece of the hologram effect that was used in the movie. This was kind of a silhouette-based technique where we were trying to recover the shape of things just by using contours from multiple viewing angles. And then in Star Wars, we were using kind of the complementary side of the technology where you guess the depth or position at every single pixel of the thing that you're looking at. And if you take a bunch of pictures and accumulate all these depth estimates, you can come up with a very detailed shape of something that you're observing. And we use that for some of the terrain in the Clone Wars sequence.
So when you're deriving depth of pixels, there's probably, there's probably two obvious ways that comes to mind. You can get depth from a single optical source by doing some kind of optical flow analysis that produces relative motion as a hint, but you'd be doing it by triangulating or epipolar geometry. Is that the approach?
Yeah. Actually, the two become the same thing, or we treat them the same thing, the same way in our system. Two different vantage points, and we track or correspond pixels across the images. And you either do it very densely, or you use higher level image cues like silhouettes to give you bounds on where that shape has to be.
Because what you're trying to do is kind of get the definition of what the object is, I guess, to isolate it, and then work out based on the object the relative depth, and then presumably map textures that are gleaned from the multiple viewpoints to produce the reconstruction?
Exactly, and I think that's one of the benefits of it is we get not only the depth, but we get very tightly registered image information. So if there's ever any question about the depth or if there's an artifact or defect, an artist can always look at the original source pictures and gain a little bit more trust about what the reconstruction did and fix any problems and the way it's important to them.
Because while the technology is very impressive, it's a natural consequence of the complexity of the footage. There are going to be, for want of a better term, errors or noise or artifacts. And so I understand that you have basically both some kind of interactive and, of course, filtering ways to deal with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the critical component of the system. You know, all of our technologies we try to introduce along with an artist authoring tool because we know that we have humans in the mix at all times, you know, in the production process rather than a robot going to Mars that has to be all automatic. So we try to take advantage of knowing that we have a human user in the loop and also parameterize the problem in a way that they can make corrections and it makes sense to the solver. So when we do these reconstructions, we have some interesting, nice tools for the artists to guide where the reconstruction, where there might be some errors or to fix things in a way that's really natural for the problem that we're dealing with, the sort of interactive paint and sculpting tools to get right at where the errors might be.
So the way that most people, I think, would think of image-based modeling is the sort of generic demo that one might see at a trade show where somebody gets three photographs of a building and then manually picks points and that triangulates to produce as we discussed, the epipolar geometry to work out, you know, relative depth, and then you use some tools on that point cloud to kind of model it and then, of course, resolve the textures as we discussed. But the ILM system is able to do much more because, as you already indicated, we're going way beyond sort of fixed, static, rigid bodies to human capture, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Right. So there was a previous SciTech Award back in 2002 for a Mars system, which was essentially one of those photogrammetry systems that had also a nice interface and was really production-friendly, but that made it very straightforward and reliable for us to be able to calibrate camera views, pick out isolated points in space, and sort of connect them with simple geometry. That doesn't work for a lot of very common and important cases in visual effects, like human forms, organic terrain, lots of deformable surfaces. You know, it's really good for man-made stuff, but not for a lot of natural stuff. And modelers were asking us, well, this is great. It's kind of like a survey tool, but it doesn't really help me model complicated shapes that I want for these creatures or whatever the topic is. So this work is sort of the next step beyond that, beyond the photogrammetry work.
So if I had an actor, it's quite viable to use the system to be producing a model of them to use for what, for example, stunt work, is that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like digital double reference.
Yeah.
And, you know, there have been systems around for a long time that will scan actors using laser scanners, and they work fine in a lot of cases. But what we found on very high-end applications is that, for example, laser scanning requires the actor to stay very stationary for 10 seconds or whatever it is. And actors can't do that. They invariably move a little bit, and the artists only gets the scan back, and they can never tell what's wrong about it. It may just look a little bit weird, but they can't back that out to say, oh, here's where the problem is. And you go one step further to cases like children that will not stay still for 10 seconds, and you simply can't scan them in a reasonable way. So we built the system specifically to address those cases that we couldn't address through the vendor technologies that existed at the time.
Right. And so just if somebody had, for example, maquette or something that was done for a, would you still use a cyber scan on that, or would, does the system actually get used outside of the points you've illustrated?
It gets used for a number of things. It's most useful when you're looking at footage after the fact, so where there was no scanning even possible because you're doing, say, a helicopter shot, or you're using archival footage, or you're looking at a plate a long time later and you're being asked to reconstruct something that you didn't know about at the time the shot was done. You can certainly model maquettes and things like that with this technology, but if it's a stationary static object of that kind of size and the scanner works, then just use the scanner. I mean, it's fine for that. You know, we don't say use this for everything. We still want it to be a complementary tool along with other techniques like LiDAR and cyber scanning.
Right, right. And so how would you rate it in terms of the usability? Like how massive a job, I mean, it's a piece of string, I know, but do artists find that it's quite quick to work this way, or is it still a very, very painstaking process?
It's gotten a lot faster over the past few years. And we can turn around a basic model. You can go out and shoot a couple pictures and have something turned around in, you know, 15 minutes to half an hour. If you just want something simple and it's a good subject matter. And again, it doesn't require fancy camera rigs. It's just a handheld camera. Get some parallax on something, and if there's texture on it, then you can reconstruct it pretty straightforward. I guess, you know, we have an artist in the loop, so when they want something very specific or when the data is not very good and they're having to fake it or supplement what the solver found, then it can take time, and you do want a technical user. And since our tools are proprietary, we take for granted that we have that person there, so we don't over-polish something like you would for a consumer product that's going out to totally amateur people. So we always leave our tools a little bit rough, but we take usability into account because if it's too hard, people just won't use it.
Yeah, I can imagine, given an option of polishing the icons or getting some more functionality, the artists are going to pick more functionality every single time. But the good thing is, of course, it isn't actually any specialist equipment, so it is possible for almost anyone to use it in that sense because you can just grab, as you said, an ordinary camera. It's not a complicated scanner array. It's not, you have to go to a special location to do it. It's pretty much free and flexible, isn't it?
Right. So our match movers who are familiar with the techniques will go out on set, and they'll look for cases where, hey, this seems like a good case for stereo reconstruction. It's a, say, an organic shape, and a modeler's going to need to reproduce it, but there's no way to survey or measure that thing. So they take pictures, you know, a few pictures the right way, and then they've got what they need, and they can reconstruct it or not after the fact, depending on what the shot needs.
One of the other things, I'm going to diverge now, but one of the other great things that's come up in the same round with the Academy is the work that your department's done in the area of developing and, for that matter, publishing the OpenEXR system. And so you actually this year are being honored twice, aren't you?
Yeah, not me personally, but ILM certainly is, and R&D is receiving two awards, which is great. I don't know how else to put it. We're pretty shocked. Yeah, OpenEXR is a project that we're really proud of because it addressed an important need for us and for the industry, and we took the approach several years ago of making it open source with the intent that if we made it available, the rest of the industry could solve the same problem that we had. It wasn't really a competitive edge. It was more important that we be able to share information back and forth and hopefully get it into the tools and support it in the tools so that anybody could author images in this format and then we could share them back and forth. It's one of those cases where the technology was more important for collaboration externally than some advantage internally.
And who headed up that research in your department?
Quite a few people. So Florian Kynes is really the mastermind behind it, and he's receiving the award this year. But also Rod Bogart did a tremendous amount of work, and Drew Hess as well. They didn't get reflected in the award, but people should know that they've put a lot of work into it, among many other people in the department.
So let's discuss OpenEXR briefly. I mean, the thing that I, as you've already touched on, found terrific was the fact that it became open source and that you published it. And you published it at a very critical time because HDR was taking off and everyone was looking for a file format that had the characteristics of not being huge for the data workflow, but also was both flexible and could handle floating point. And it's really been adopted pretty widely, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. You know, it took some effort at first, and then it sort of took off when people saw that it really is free, and it's well-engineered, no strings attached, and it works, you know, because ILM uses it, and we use it for real. It's been pounded on, and it's a solid system, and it addresses a real need that people had, which is going beyond the compressed dynamic range photography that we've been suffering with. So the artists appreciated it because it took some constraints off of them. Facilities and vendors appreciated it because they could interchange and talk more easily. And obviously researchers appreciated it because they were given a piece of technology that, you know, having to write it over and over again yourself is just kind of a waste of time.
So OpenEXR is actually not just a kind of raw floating point 32-bit. It's actually a half 16-bit float, isn't it, as a file format?
Yeah, there are a few formats tucked in there, but they have a consistent API. We actually worked with NVIDIA to make it compatible with their frame buffers. And that was a tweak that we made in collaboration with the vendors to make it even more appealing to the mass market.
And the thing that really allowed OpenEXR to flourish, perhaps, is the fact that in addition to carrying the color information at higher bit depth than we previously had, it acts as a container. OpenEXR isn't so much HDR as it is a container that carries HDR. And that extension alone has allowed for massive amounts of other data to be carried along in the pipeline. Can you just discuss how that works briefly?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point and good way of thinking about it. This technology, just like the image-based modeling stuff and a lot of other things, are inspired by real production problems. And when you're pushing an image around inside the studio or pushing an image between studios, you always need some extra information that's context for that image because it's meant to be part of the sequence and maybe a version of several different takes that have been tried. And so it's critical to be able to carry that information, and you want to write that carrier in a way that's generic, so it's not just the way ILM did it, but other people can morph it for their needs. So we've done upgrades to EXR over the years for things like that. Also, multi-resolution texture support, tiling support, some real-time playback support, just addressing actual needs that people have when they're trying to use this in their productions.
And the great thing is that the OpenEXR files themselves can be compressed. I mean, there are ways of doing that. But even at straight OpenEXR, you know, without sort of compression, we're not talking about unmanageably large file sizes. We've not. It's I guess hitting the higher end of what we want in terms of file sizes, but it's certainly not because there obviously are other HDR formats that are vastly bigger, just on a megabyte basis per a frame of film, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the critical things for adoption here internally. You know, we had to win over people internally first. This space is always precious, even today, and certainly years ago it was. And so the file size was a major factor in whether it was going to be adopted. And so a lot of work and thought by Florian and the team went into how do you make lossless and good lossy compression schemes to get this thing into real production pipelines without killing the disk resources.
So OpenEXR has been adopted by a number of companies, and when I say that, I mean both by equipment manufacturers and people building pipelines for facilities. And that basically means that it's pretty much possible, even though there may be slightly different implementations, to have OpenEXR running on a Fusion, running, you know, with various things that are handling LUTs and stuff. How do you keep, as a community, that on track? Because there are now effectively multiple versions or multiple paths to the code development. How is that? What's ILM's role in keeping that sort of as a standard?
Well, it's pretty active. We didn't just throw it out there and then say, okay, world, here it is, you know, do with it what you will. We recognize that open source wasn't a way for us to get other people to do the work for us. It was a way to get our work out there freely. So we still treat it as it's something that we're responsible for. We need to make the updates ourselves. We need to watch the community to advise people and make sure that any changes they're making are advisable changes. And it's cost us, you know, a lot of resources. It's been a significant effort to keep that going. It's not freeware by any means. But we think it sort of paid back in the end by having this benefit of now the world speaks OpenEXR and we can communicate with people. Tools come in the door from vendors that we buy and want to use, and it supports our format, and it's just been a win-win all around.
Well, it certainly has been a significant contribution, and it's great that it's been acknowledged by the technical community. And as we started the discussion, it really is something incredibly worth having this acknowledgement, because it really is a very quite serious evaluation process for its role in filmmaking, as we discussed, and so to be recognized twice for having contributed to the art is well, it's kind of showing off, really.
Yeah, we're what can I say, we're pretty happy about it.
Yeah, well, look, congratulations, and in both cases that's terrific, and I I use OpenEXR myself. I'd love to use the image-based modeling stuff, but it's obviously not open source. But for people that are interested in the open source stuff for OpenEXR, there is actually an OpenEXR user group, and you can have a digest or an email thing, and that you can keep in touch with what's happening in the OpenEXR community. Well, again, Steve, thank you so much for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
No problem at all. I was glad to discuss it.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. I just want to point out again that we've got some really great information on our online article about the ILM research, along with some really killer imagery. We also have an interview with Dr. Bill Collis from the Foundry about the Furnace plugins as well. Now, before we go, I just want to mention one other VFX-related SciTech Award winner, and that's Revision Effects, who were awarded with a Technical Achievement Awards for their optical flow-based software solutions, and that includes things like Real Smart Motion Blur, Reflex, Twixter, and as well as FieldKit. So congratulations to the folks at Revision for their award as well. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. For my co-founders, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide, LLC.